This podcast may contain language that's not appropriate for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Today we're going over Just Like Heaven. Excuse me, Just Like Heaven. So, if you haven't seen it and don't want us to ruin it for you, you may want to pass on this one, and we'll catch you next time. Are you ready for one dry kiss? The one that makes me scream, she says. The one that makes me laugh, she says, threw her arms around my chest. All right. I'll run away with you. I'll run away with you.
Oh, see, it's going to like, we could sing the whole thing till we get to the actual title of the movie, but that'll probably be like a minute or so. So let me just go ahead and tell all our gentle listeners that welcome to One Dry Kiss, our cussy, irreverent love letter to rom-com movies, where today we are experience a little slice of something that's just like heaven. And by just like heaven, I mean the movie with Mark Garofalo and Reese Witherspoon. And I am here with my bestie who, knowing her, has been just like a little slice of heaven for 40 some odd years, Corinne Edding.
Aww. And I'm here with Tamara, the one who always makes me scream, she says, with laughter.
Okay, good. I was like, please don't say that. That sounds very strange.
Miss Tamara Cosio.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll take it. I will take it all day long. You know, I worked for a short period of time with Reese Witherspoon's mother.
Oh, what? Wait, you're like, yes, one degree of separation from Reese Witherspoon, and you've been holding out on me.
Yes, I was working in this like really posh baby shop that had a location in Santa Monica, and we all the locations got together for the holiday party, and there was an older lady that I didn't recognize, and like, oh yeah, that's so-and-so, her name. I forgot what it is at this point. That's Reese Witherspoon's mom. And I was like, shut up. Fine lady, nothing wrong with her, but when we did the white elephant gift exchange, oh my God, she was hamming it up. She like took 20 minutes to pick her present, and then somebody took it, and she's like, oh my God, should I steal her present? No. Should I steal that person's present? No. What should I do, everybody? What do you think I should do? And so I was just like, oh my gosh, you can see where the actress gets it from. So how are you, Corinne?
Well, I am back on my medication, so that's good.
That's great. Yeah. I knew that fungus was going to go away by itself, but I'm glad that you're like expediting it with cream.
This is not about fungus. This is about mental health and ADD. And one of the problems with having ADD is not being able to do anything on a reliable and consistent basis. And so,
got it.
Taking my drugs can sometimes slip off into a non-existent state. And as I was like trying to get work done last week and being like, usually I'm doing stuff now, but I'm just kind of like staring off into nothingness, being like, wow, I wonder what's going on with me.
The colors.
Yes. This has been lasting for several days. And then on Sunday or Monday, I realized, oh, wait a minute, Corinne, you're not taking your medication. That helps you to focus a little bit and also helps you with your mental health. It's like a twofer. Why wouldn't I do it? There's no side effects other than being able to actually get work done.
Because nobody puts baby in a corner. You can't tell Corinne what to do.
That's true.
She does what she wants.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know me. So, Miss Tamara, now that I'm back on the choo-choo medication track, what about you? What are you up to?
I have a PSA because there's a couple of people in my life that started listening to this podcast. And I just have to say, apropos of nothing, Larry is the best lover I've ever had in my whole entire life. And Casey hears this.
I actually would. I mean, I don't think there's a lie there. So I... Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But yeah. He's been saying stuff and doing stuff, and then he's kind of been on the side like, are you going to talk about this on your podcast? And I'm like, no. He's like, why not? And I'm like, I don't know. And he goes, oh, something else comes up. Are you going to talk about this on your podcast? And I'm like, why do you care? He goes, oh, I just started listening to a couple of episodes. Oh, no. Which I'm just like, that's totally fine. And I was like, okay, I'll give you a little shout out and I'll say something you'll really like next time we're on, okay? Next time we record, I got you.
I would also like to say that I am a lover of Larry, but not a lover of Larry, just that I'm a fan.
It's just like I make you scream
with laughter. Dot, 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 with laughter.
Yes, yes, yes. You're a lover of Larry, completely completely platonically.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, yes.
No, I like him because he makes you happy.
Yes. I think this is going to be a theme that we have, inappropriate things that dot, dot, dot aren't inappropriate once you add the little extension.
Yeah.
The disclaimer, if you will. I think that's like, oh, that's speaking of themes. Sorry. Top of the show. I should have said that this is our new theme for October, our newish theme for October, which is Corinne.
Oh, I wrote it down on a piece of paper next to my desk that I forgot to put in the spreadsheet. It's supernatural paranormal sweeties.
Absolutely right. And that name most definitely sticks in your head, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't stick in your head. That's why you asked me. So I know. I see you, Gabe.
I knew it. Uh-huh. I knew it. I was just trying to include you in the conversation.
Oh, yeah. That's I was over here like looking about. Real mad, being like, oh, why is she doing all the tucking? Oh, God.
It's like a tennis game. I lob the ball into your side of the court and you lob it back.
And Tamara, the Pythagorean theory is, I'm just lobbing the ball back to you. I'm lobbing the ball back.
Okay, there's something different between Pythagorean theory and what the theme is this month. There's a difference. There's a big difference. One directly correlates to the show. The other one, I have no freaking idea what that even is. I don't even know what that is.
Oh, I'm just going to say that regardless of all this business, that Tamara really loves me because she gave me some beautiful John Heater, Hater, whatever sections in this movie. And I'm so excited about it.
Again, that phrase was slightly inappropriate till you added the extension to it. I gave you some lovely John Heater sections. Oh, sections, sections. Yeah, yeah.
Spelled S-E-X.
I was thinking those.
T-I-O.
Ah. Yeah. Oh no, it's too early to have to go to the bathroom. Speaking of sex,
yes,
sex yawns, Corinne, do you have a synopsis?
Why, yes, I do. I have a very lovingly crafted synopsis.
A sexual, sectional synopsis?
Actually, it's not that sexy, but it does take us down a little tangent, as I am wont to do.
Okay.
In 4000 BC, there was an...
Oh, I'm just kidding. What the fuck? I'm like, woo, how's this going to circle around and how long is it going to take?
No. So, in this modern version of Snow White, a super work-focused Dr. Elizabeth, played by Reese Witherspoon, ends up in a coma, and a grieving widower, David, played by Mark Ruffalo, ends up being the prince who kisses her. There are absolutely no dwarves or evil witches, but there is a super douchey doctor who I affectionately call Dr. Duty Thurston, because I am five. Or a more traditional synopsis of this would be, David, played by Mark Ruffalo, moves into a sublet apartment so he can drink his days away and eat delivery food. However, his plan for this new phase in his life is foiled, I tell you, by an apparition in the form of Elizabeth, a very career-focused doctor who recently got into a car accident. She does not appreciate having an interloper in her apartment, and he does not appreciate having an apparition watching him get out of the shower, thank you very much, and singing loudly over his basketball games. Well, David and Elizabeth end up like the odd couple, Oscar and Felix, destined to annoy each other for eternity. Will David end up going to a pottery wheel and having a sexy ghost scene with Elizabeth? Or, okay, so there was sex in this. Or will this all prove to be an alcohol-fueled dream and David can continue his descent into slovenliness in peace once he wakes up? Keep those listening ears listening to find out.
Beautifully written, Corinne.
Thank you. It took you on a journey,
lots
huh?
of words in there I didn't recognize. Yeah, I'm going to have to look some of those up later.
Oh. I live to give people a reason to open up their dictionary.
Mm. And I marvel at your vocabulary more often than not. Yes.
Same with you. Whenever I'm like reading your scripts, I'm like, ooh, that word is hot. I love it.
full of hot air and words. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It all just exudes from me.
Makes you extra floaty. So, Miss Tamara, are you ready to take us on the journey of Just Like Heaven?
To show you how I do this trick, the one that makes you scream with laughter.
Yes!
She said. Okay. Sure. Let's do that. Shall we?
Yes, we shall.
A sweet female version of Just Like Heaven by Katie Melua plays in the background as an aerial shot of a misty sky wafts by. The clouds clear, and eventually we see an elaborate garden with flowers and maize paths. There is a petite blonde woman sitting amongst the greenery. She has her eyes closed as if she's meditating, but she's not meditating because the park bench turns into a plastic chair and the garden maze fades away into a San Francisco hospital break room, and someone's shaking her. It's Elizabeth, played by Reese Witherspoon. She was asleep, and she quickly comes to and asks, "How long have I been out?" Another physician says, "About 6 minutes." And she abruptly gets up and grabs a cup of coffee from the machine behind her. The liquid spewing from this machine looks like 7-year-old motor oil, but Elizabeth seems unfazed by this. Her mentor, Dr. Fran, plays by Rosalind Chow, comes in and asks how long she's been awake. And Elizabeth says nonchalantly, "About 23 hours. Dr. Fran demands that she goes home, but Liz refuses. "That's not how I'm going to get the attending physician." We next get a montage of Elizabeth attending to numerous patients. She's a good physician because she knows all of her patients' names, conditions, and appropriate treatments. And then we see her go above and beyond, like accepting an over-medicated elderly patient's wedding proposal, making a balloon animal out of a surgical glove for a scared little girl in a wheelchair, and saving her arch nemesis, a.k.a. rival attending physician, Dr. What was his name, Corinne?
Duty Thurston.
Dr. Duty Thurston. His real name's Brett, so Dr. Brett, a.k.a. Duty Thurston, by tranquilizing an aggressive patient who's trying to assault him. Things are hectic in the hospital that she works at, but Elizabeth seems to be handling it in stride with nothing to keep her going except sludgy, gross-looking coffee.
Next, we see the ladies' room. Meet me in the ladies' room.
Be back real soon.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. They're not singing that in the movie. We are. As an aside.
But they should be singing it because there's a bunch of them all gathered together. Dr. Fran, the supervising physician, is attempting to dab concealer under her eyes. Elizabeth enters and asks, "Going full kabuki tonight, Fran?" And that, my friends, is what we call a microaggression. A slightly racist but well-intended comment. Yay! As Dr. Fran is Asian. Her mentor admits, and she was more importantly on Star Trek The Next Generation. Yay!
Okay.
And Deep Space Nine, I believe, too. Yay!
Does she play a doctor in either of those?
I don't think so.
But she was in space, so it counts.
She was in space. She was a woman in space, which is really important.
That's nice that Rosalind Chow tends to play women that are in STEM.
Yeah. She is awesome, and she plays women in STEM. Gosh darn it. Yes. Her mentor, Dr. Fran, admits that she's on her way to dinner with her ex-husband, who hasn't had the gonads to tell his parents that they've divorced, and she doesn't want to be responsible for an 80-year-old's death, which is very charitable of her.
Yes.
Yeah. Another doctor emerges from the bathroom stall proclaiming, "Well, I've got to make multiple caterpillar costumes with Velcro legs for my kids' class." Yet another doctor admits, "I don't know how you do it. My husband is pushing to have kids, and I don't even have time to shave my legs." Dr. Fran hands Elizabeth a lipstick. She glances at it, shrugs, and starts applying it to her lips. Dr. Fran says, "Don't shave your legs. That'll solve the problem." And as a woman whose legs are frequently unshaven, other than the guy that I went out with who had a stand-up routine with a joke about how horrified he was that he went out with a woman who didn't shave her legs, true story, for the most part, men don't care if you shave your legs or not. Oh, Larry cares.
Some of the guys in my life well, he doesn't care because he's like, "You're lucky you're hairless." And I'm like, "If I wasn't, would it be a problem?" But I know that my ex oftentimes used to remark about the spider nest I had underneath my arms if I didn't shave my pits.
Oh, did he have have hairless underarms?
No, they all had hair too, and I did that whole like, why is it okay for you to have hairy armpits but not me? Because you were a girl. Okay, fair response. I'm just gonna go shave right now because that makes so much sense.
You're like, so if I have spider nests under my arms, what in the ever-loving hell is under yours? Because, ooh, there should be a Nat Geo special about what's going on there.
Yeah, well, there's a reason why he's an ex.
Freedom, freedom, freedom. To show those beautiful hairy.
And Corinne said that with her armpits in the sky.
Yeah.
And now she's gyrating them. Giving them some air.
Sexy, sexy natural armpits. I do shave my pits, but that's my choice. Gosh darn it. My legs, however, are, for a lot of the time, they have a beautiful braided, you know, macrame kind of look to them.
You know, I guess it's appropriate to ask if the drapes match the floor, because if your legs are hairy, then I'm not talking about your cooch. Is your hair silver like the top of your head on your legs, Corinne?
No, it's only the top of my head is where I have the silver hair. Everywhere else is dark.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Including my eyebrows, and they better stay dark. I'm threatening you, eyebrows. I'm threatening you.
Wow.
I know. So, anyways, now that we've gone on the shaving legs tangent, Dr. Frank, the final part of that is they will still totally have sex with you regardless of whether your legs are shaved or not. Elizabeth dabs the lipstick onto her lips and the caterpillar costuming physician looks at her and puts a hand on her shoulder saying, "You're so lucky you only have to worry about work." Elizabeth looks like she wants to poke her in the eyes, but refrains. And after the bathroom empties out and she's there all alone, she looks down sadly because maybe that's not all she'd like to worry about. All by myself. Too busy being a doctor, so I'm all by myself.
And that concludes the meeting in the ladies' room. Be back real soon. You know that song? I just have to say it before we move on to the next section.
Uh-huh.
There is a part, if you can find that song, I have no idea who sings it offhand, but in the middle of the song, "Don't you do it, Corinne. Don't you do it."
I was like, is it the Weather Girls?
I don't think so. But there is a middle portion where she talks about getting in a fight with somebody. And literally there's like three or four lines where she's like, "Don't slap me because I'm not in the mood. Don't slap me because I'm not in the mood."
Wow.
And she says it so emphatically. I'm like, if I was in a bathroom with her and she told me not to slap her because she's not in the mood, I would probably hightail it out of there and won't even wash my hands. Yes, I would.
Oof. No kidding. I'd be like, bye. Back away, back away, back away. It's by Climax. I did it. Okay, Tam, I did it. I could not help myself.
Climax. Yeah, I'll just add it to the inappropriateness of this episode. It's fine.
No, but it's spelled with a K, so it's okay.
Oh, it's K.
Climax with the K. Y-M. It's either two A's and an X. Or
did they really put a Y?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
They mangled the spelling of it, so it made it okay.
Yeah. See?
Climax. Suck.
Yeah, it's K-L-Y-M-A-X-X.
Maybe the K silent and it's Limax.
That sounds like our infomercial's ready to begin. With Limax, you can clean the dirtiest of surfaces.
Is your bathroom not appropriate for a meeting? Try Limax.
Then all your ladies will be there real soon. Limax. It brings the ladies together.
Anyways, that was good. Good tangent. Good times. Elizabeth's thoughts are interrupted by her assisting nurse, who drags her out of the restroom to look at an x-ray. She diagnoses the image deftly when her phone rings. It's her sister Abby confirming that Elizabeth is going to show up for dinner that night. They have a guy lined up for her to meet aka a blind date. Elizabeth assures Abby that she's coming and is not opposed to dating. She's just been really busy. Her sister pushes back, I know, I would just like you to meet somebody who's not bleeding for once. Elizabeth retorts, I meet people. In fact, I've had 2 marriage proposals today. The same elderly geriatric patient blurts out, marry me. To which Elizabeth conveys triumphantly, 3 marriage proposals. Her sister's appeased, so Elizabeth continues on, winding up behind rival Brett Butt Thurston, while he informs a fellow colleague that he has 2 outstanding offers for attending physician positions, and it's between San Francisco and Phoenix.
And to be clear, they live in San Francisco. He's talking about this job.
San Francisco or Phoenix? I would go for San Francisco. Corinne, what would you go for?
Oh, please. Any day, San Francisco. I am not a desert girl.
Okay.
No.
I'm just regaling myself with that conversation we had where I was like, I want to move to San Francisco. And you said, I will never come visit you ever if you move to San Francisco. And I was like, okay.
I wouldn't live in San Francisco, but I would take a job in San Francisco over.
Yes. And obviously would not come to visit your bestie in San Francisco if they resided in the city limits.
It would be difficult.
Yes.
But you could come and visit me real easily because there's parking.
Of course I could.
It's easy. I'm walking distance for public transport. I mean, it's just there's so many ways that it's super easy.
Well, it's a good thing I don't live there. But Dr. Thurston haughtily adds, old people and melanoma versus desperate women and great sushi.
Ugh.
A gunshot victim gets wheeled in, and Dr. Walsh, who has jurisdiction over Elizabeth and Brett's residency, watches him get taken to a room. Elizabeth and Brett stand in front of him, eager for the opportunity to attend the injury, and Dr. Walsh eyes them inquisitively. He asks Brett, how long have you been here? Brett confidently proclaims, about 12 hours. He asks Elizabeth the same, and she responds less enthusiastically, a few more. Dr. Walsh immediately chooses Brett to attend, leaving Elizabeth defeated, but not for long. When Brett's out of earshot, Dr. Walsh gladly informs her that he's chosen her for the residency Yay! Position, stating, you care more about the patient's well-being than kissing my ass like Brett. A bold move, but it worked. Elizabeth enthusiastically accepts a position. And she tries heading back towards her patients, but Dr. Walsh stops her and says, the only thing I need you to do right now is go home. You've been here 26 hours. She looks dumbfounded that he knows, and he looks back slyly and says, I know all. So her promotion was not unfounded. That fucker knew what was going on. He sees all, he knows all, and she is the better doctor, hands down.
I'd just like to take a moment to acknowledge that now we have met the 2 people of color in the entire movie.
But they're both doctors, so yes. let's acknowledge that.
Yeah. Her mentor, Dr. Fran, and then the big bad of them all who just gave Elizabeth her dream job.
I actually think that one of Elizabeth's neighbors way, 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 way down later in the movie might be Asian. I'm not sure, but I think his one line is, no, nobody lives there.
Ooh,
a pivotal moment in the movie, though. A pivotal moment.
Color me corrected. You're like,
yes. Yep.
And then you see some people walking down the street. Yeah.
Oh, I remember vividly when I still lived in the Bay Area, and Woody Allen, fucking Woody Allen, had the gall to make a movie and set it in San Francisco. Do not care to know what the movie was. Did not commit it to memory at all. And every single person in that movie was like Italian or Jewish. And I was like, fine, but have you been to San Francisco ever?
Oh, Woody Allen, you are so problematic.
Yay.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if we never do a Woody Allen movie, I will be happy with that.
Outcome. Oh, if you say Woody Allen, I might have to veto and be like, no.
I start saying, you're like, I hope you're saying Woody from Toy Story, because that's the only thing I want to be hearing about.
Yes, there is a love story in that. There is one.
Next, we see Elizabeth leaving work dressed in her street clothes. She's running late to dinner. She calls her sister Abby from the car and regales her with the good news that she got the residency in San Francisco. What, what? She's staying! Woohoo! Her sister is thrilled and tells her to hurry over so they can celebrate. Elizabeth hangs up, turns up the radio. She's happily listening to Let the Good Times Roll. Let the good times roll. When suddenly, beep, beep, she looks up terrified. She's not going to make it to her sister's, as she and a container truck have had an abrupt and crashy meeting.
Oh.
But we don't find out what happens, because next we cut to David, played by Mark Ruffalo. He's apartment hunting with a realtor, but they're not having any luck. Okay, but really, she is showing our man, a man of the people, a man who, when he gets home, wants a comfy couch and a good place to set his to-go containers on and a nice TV to sit and watch. This realtor is showing him very pricey, very esoteric places. I mean, who needs a couch and a TV when you can sit on a meditation cushion and look at an indoor Zen sand garden?
Well, I mean, that's just what realtors do, though, sometimes. They're like, you want a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house in the suburbs in a nice, quiet neighborhood? Have you seen this loft downtown?
I just don't think you're being clear with me.
You just have to be creative and be open-minded.
Yeah.
Just be creative and open-minded.
You know, if you throw some clothing lines from wall to wall and you hang some sheets over them, it's like you have walls in this gigantic space. Isn't that amazing?
That you can see through and hear through. Yay. Just as good as walls. Absolutely.
Just as good as walls.
Just like that. Meditation cushions as good as a couch.
Oh, those meditation cushions look so hard. So, Tamara, maybe you want something more modern with a couch that is about as soft as a park bench but offers less support. Huh? How about that?
I actually did like that second space, aside from all the art, I guess, which looked like it was of the person that lived there. Like, it was a pretty cool space. I would have just gotten like one of the, I don't know, a lot of pillows for that very uncomfortable looking couch.
That couch was very uncomfortable looking, yes. But I would choose that couch over the meditation cushions.
For sure.
Or maybe an apartment that had previously been occupied by Liberace, replete with gold chandeliers, Victorian couches with a million golden pillows, and ass-forward naked men sculptures. Yarr. I totally did not get it when I watched this movie at the time. Poor, poor little old sheltered whatever me, because I, for one, she's like, oh, the people who live here, they're in Palm Springs most of the time these days. And I was like, okay, Palm Springs is gay vacation central. Let's start with that. Did not pick up on that. Did not pick up on the ass forward, like, even though they emphasized it in the movie, the ass forward sculptures where he's like sitting on the uncomfortable couch flanked by a million pillows that are threatening to eat him. And he looks to his right, there's some ass cheeks, and he looks to his left and there's some ass cheeks on the other side. And he's like, I don't know if I want to sit on a couch flanked by ass cheeks. I just don't know about this.
And to be fair, it is San Francisco.
It's San Francisco, and I'm guessing two old queens who live there have a very good life where they spend a lot of time drinking and partying with their friends, and most of the time do it in Palm Springs these days, which is great. But it was not a fit for our man of the people, Mr. Mark Ruffalo, a.k.a. David. The real estate agent is at her wit's end, and she implores him as they stand outside the most recent disaster apartment. I've shown you some of the best apartments on the market. I just don't get it. Maybe you can tell me more of what you're looking for so I can better help you. But he's not interested in sharing. Suddenly, a gust of wind blows a flyer for an apartment sublet off a nearby corkboard onto David's leg. David rips it off his leg and tosses it to the side, but it keeps flying back to him, ultimately smacking him in the face, so he can't ignore it. God damn it, you're going to read this flyer if you like it. Fate is telling you again and again. Have you not seen the movie Serendipity, David? Have you?
No, no, Corinne. Wrong. Although that one was also in San Francisco. Maybe he can hear the shanais from Tiburon.
Yes. As it wafts over the waters of the bay. Yes. David looks at the paper, shows it to the realtor, and she assures him there's no way that's still around. But David sees the address is literally across the street and strolls towards the apartment. The real estate agent totters after him in her heels, saying, "Okay, I'll call them, but I don't think this is going to do any good."
Mm-hmm. And she was wrong, because next we see them getting a tour of the property. It is still available, but the lease is month to month, and the owners are very hush-hush about the details. It's a lovely apartment with fantastic views and a fireplace. David finds a door during the tour, and it leads to a private bare rooftop terrace. It's completely empty, but the possibilities are endless. Back inside, he finds a couch, sits in it, and proclaims, "It's a good couch." The realtor realizes it's a done deal, and he quickly moves in. Then we get a montage of all his fabulous plans for his new place, which consists of him sitting on the good couch, drinking beers, and ordering takeout.
Oh.
Day in and day out. Mm-hmm. Big plans. He looks absolutely miserable, and the only clue we get to his misery is a home movie showing a woman in a wedding dress. The pile of trash on his coffee table has gotten quite large when David goes for a beer refill and almost smacks right into Elizabeth.
Ooh.
They are both scared shitless at the sight of each other. She begs him not to steal anything, that she'll give him bus fare for a homeless shelter if he just leaves. He protests, "I'm not homeless, I live here." She looks at him sympathetically and says, "This can't be your apartment because this is my apartment." David has a revelation and exclaims, "Ugh, don't you see what happened? It's a rental scam where they rent the apartment to two people and keep the money."
Mm.
Elizabeth assures him that that's not the case because this is all of her stuff. She notices the pile of trash and chastises him for being a pig and quickly goes to the kitchen get a mop. He follows close behind, but when he gets to the kitchen, she's vanished. He goes from room to room in the apartment searching for her, but she's nowhere to be found. We then see him put a slide lock on the front door, but it's no use.
I was like, "No, that door is beautiful wood. What are you doing?" As he's screwing this lock into the door, I was like, "Ah."
I would do the same thing. I'm sorry. My safety is paramount to anything else.
Good luck from protecting yourself from a woman who just disappears.
Yeah, those are the worst kind.
I know.
The next day, when he's taking a shower, he rubs the steam off a mirror and sees Elizabeth's reflection commanding him, "Get out!" But once again, when he turns, she's gone. This is so funny because this one little snippet of a part reminds me of that My Favorite Murder episode where Karen talks about meeting Mark Ruffalo on a rooftop terrace party. And then in this movie, he's on a rooftop terrace. And I'm like, oh my God. I wonder if it's that rooftop terrace. I know it's not, but it'd be so cool if it was. But they weren't in San Francisco. It was LA. So never mind.
But we can dream.
Oh, for sure.
Yes. Also, I think you left out the most important part of this all.
What?
When he gets out of his shower, he peers around, he cleans the mirror, scared of seeing her reflection. He slurps his shower beer. You left out the shower beer.
Oh, I'm so sorry. He slurped his shower beer before wiping the mirror and then seeing Elizabeth. And then, but he did drop the shower beer. Rest assured, the shower beer was safe.
It was safe. Thank goodness. Save the shower beer. Save the shower beer.
Don't you see all those like funny videos where somebody like eats shit, tumbles down a hill, but they don't spill their beer. So they're like, I still got my beer.
Yeah.
So that was like the Mark Ruffalo version. Or the David in Just Like Heaven version.
I like that version better because I don't like seeing people fall. I feel bad.
It takes the edge off, though, when they're triumphantly holding their beer up going, look at what I did. So they're not that
bad. Yeah, that's true. We at the Society of Save the Shower Beer are relieved that his beer was safe. And we give this a 5 shower beer rating so you can watch it and know. No shower beers were harmed in the making of this movie.
Yes, if there was, we would have put a disclaimer at the top of the show.
Yes, yes.
SOS, save our shower beer.
Yes. The last experience concerns David because he, you know,
he was having his shower beer, but like the buzz was interrupted because, hello, reflection of Elizabeth. And he reaches out to his friend Jack, who also happens to be a psychiatrist. They have a coffee in an outdoor cafe, and David admits, I'm seeing someone. Jack is thrilled until David elaborates, no, I'm seeing someone that's not there. Jack, confused, asks, what, emotionally unavailable? David shakes his head. No, like not real. He gives his psychiatrist friend the details, and Jack asks suspiciously, were you drunk when you saw this person? David reluctantly agrees, but assures, yes, but the shower beer was safe. I was wasted, but I still shouldn't see a blonde control freak running around my apartment. Jack is jotting all of this down, and David somberly mutters, I gotta quit drinking. However, Jack doesn't like this idea. Lord forbid he quit drinking. I'm like, he's like, no, don't do that. And I'm like, what the fuck? Okay. I mean, it's fine. One's decision to drink is their own decision. But like, if somebody says, I gotta quit drinking, when they've been spending most of their days drunk, and you're like, no, don't do that. I'm like, what? Why? It's okay not to drink, Jack. It's okay. Just breathe. Just breathe.
Enabler.
But Jack has great reason for this. He encourages his friend, drink. Just do it out with other people. Alcohol was made to give men courage and to make women loose.
Yeah, there it is.
There it is.
There's the early 2000s in this movie. There it is.
Yeah. Because if you drink with other people, you don't have a drinking problem, right? Right? Right?
Right.
Right. Also, thanks for the gross rapey comment, Jack. It was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Exactly. There was, right. Yep. Just the period on the end of that beautiful sentence.
Jack continues opening his arms dramatically. This is the world. Join it and stop swimming around alone in your mind, because that's dangerous territory. Now, he has a point there. Mm. Swimming around alone in your mind can be dangerous territory.
But you just got to get into the public alcohol pool and not just the private one you sit in at home.
Because then you're not an alcoholic.
Bring those shower beers out. Come on, man. They're only called shower beers because they're in the shower. They could also be out in the world beers if you just take them outside.
Oh, yeah. Or it can be raining a little, and so your shower beer can be in a shower of rain amongst other people. Ah.
Right. Yes. Yeah. There's many situations where this could work.
Uh-huh.
All kinds of scenarios fit the beer.
Yes. There's always a situation that fits the beer. Thank goodness. The Shower Beer Alliance agrees. Jack continues, come on, Dave, it's been 2 years, no more hiding out. David assures his friend that he'll stop wallowing, but in the next few scenes, we see that he's back at home and nothing has changed, but fortunately his shower beers are safe.
Mm.
He's still on the couch, drinking beers and showering with beers and spending his days with beers alone, but he's got a beer, and that's like a friend in itself, I'm just saying.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But now he's tentatively looking over his shoulder, hoping not to see a blassy blonde apparition.
Blassy? Did you say blassy?
I said perfection is what I said. Blassy blonde apparition. A blassy blonde.
A blassy blonde can be blassy, though. That's awesome. New word. I love it.
Blassy blonde.
And all is quiet for a while until one night David lays down to sleep and a voice calls out, what are you doing? I thought I told you to leave. She's back. In an effort to drown out her voice, he attempts to put a pillow over his ear and insists to himself, you're not real. Elizabeth deduces that he must be mentally ill and asks him a few probing questions. Has your alcohol consumption dramatically increased? Are you seeing and hearing things that aren't there? David confirms all of this, and Elizabeth sadly tells him that you're having a mental breakdown, not realizing that the visions and things he's seeing and hearing are her. David sits up and looks at her nervously, and she iterates that this is her apartment. See that pillow right there? If you pick it up, there's a red stain on the back where I spilled cherry cough medicine. He does, and there is indeed a red stain there. Or, she continues, that these sheets are from Nordstrom. She points at a nearby table and tells him, and then that's my picture right there. Wait, what did you do to my picture? because what she's pointing at is an empty beer can strewn table. David argues, there was nothing there when I moved in. And Elizabeth is once again incensed and grabs the phone to call the police, but her hand passes through right through it as if it weren't there. Mm-hmm. She yells, what have you done with my phone? David just shakes his head in disbelief, and she threatens to use the one in the living room, but as she leaves, in a huff, the figure slowly dissipates into nothing. So her huff ended in a puff of nothingness. This prompts David to call the realtor the next day and ask about the previous tenant, and the only thing the realtor knows is that there was a family tragedy. He asks, did the previous tenant die? The realtor cackles and says, you better hope so. That's the only way you're going to get off this month-to-month lease. That apartment has a fireplace, a killer view, and a terrace. People have killed their grandmother for less. Mm-hmm. And he rightfully hangs up on her.
I actually know a couple who moved out to San Francisco from the Midwest when the woman's uncle died. And so she was kind of looped into his rental rate for his apartment.
How much was it to rent? What was the
I don't remember, but it was like low 1000s, and it was like a big spacious place in a night in Cow Hollow, which is a very pricey neighborhood.
Oh my god.
Where you can rent a house for $20,000 a month.
$20,000.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go down a rabbit hole looking at that shit when we get off here. <You're> like rentals in Cow Hollow, my god.
Yeah, it's for people who are used to living in actual houses. They'd be like, this is like an apartment. But for people who like live in apartments, they'd be like, oh, there's so much space in here, you know. Next, we see David wandering into a bookstore, studying the occult section. A salesman named Daryl, played beautifully by John Heder, asks if he needs help. David says, do you believe this stuff? Daryl answers, you don't until you do. Then gives him a knowing nod. David has pulled a book called Passing On by Brennan Byers, which shows a football player in a throwing stance. Daryl looks at his choice and offers, that's outdated, then proceeds to stack his arms full of several titles. Daryl asks if he's interested in communication, but David informs him communication is not a problem for her. Daryl nods, eyes widening, and says, righteous. David's haul would rival a couple of semesters worth of college books. He thinks he's done, but Daryl plucks one more title off the shelf, rubs it against his chest, feeling its essence. Nods and puts it on top of the pile. Now that David's armed and ready, he heads back to the apartment, lights several candles, and tries the incantations from one of the books. It doesn't work, and so he takes a mug that's handmade and has the name Elizabeth scrawled across the front in a child's handwriting, and he declares, I'm going to put this steaming hot cup of coffee onto this mahogany table without a coaster. Suddenly, Elizabeth appears and says, don't you dare.
I wrote it in the notes that when I first saw this, when I was doing the outline and it was like Passing On by Brennan Byers, I went down like a little rabbit hole trying to figure out who he was. So I'm like, oh, is that like a football player that died and came back to life? There was nothing on it. I thought there was going to be some funny story and maybe I just didn't find it. So anybody out there, gentle listeners, if you know who Brennan Byers is and why he would have wrote a book called Passing On and Just Like Heaven, please let us know, because dying to hear it.
But the bookstore that they go to in Just Like Heaven was a real bookstore in San Francisco.
It looked like it. I was like, that totally looks like a Bay Area independent bookstore. David calmly tells her that she's passed on. There should be a light somewhere around you. Go to it. Go to the light. Elizabeth still thinks he's crazy, and so he tries to prove his point by asking her, what's your name? She fumbles for a moment before noticing the mug and stating confidently, Elizabeth. Then he asks, well, when's the last time you remember talking to somebody other than me, Elizabeth? She's flustered and says less confidently, the other day, but can't give any further details. David makes his way towards her and tries to put a reassuring hand on her shoulder, but it freaks both of them out when his hand passes right through her torso. She jumps back, calls him a pervert, and argues, I'm not dead.
to which he slowly points down because she has jumped right into the dining room table. And by into, I mean her torso sitting on top of it and her legs are underneath, unseen to us, as if she has no substance. In a rage, she tries slapping David, but her hand sails right through his face and she accomplishes nothing but giving him a slight headache. She attempts to push him towards the door, but she loses her balance and accidentally tumbles through the window.
Oh no!
And down the three stories. David looks after her and says flatly, "Rest in peace." But she will not, because as soon as he turns around, she's there again.
Can't get rid of Elizabeth. She is a determined woman. And when she ends up in the middle of the table, it made me think of a movie that I've never actually seen, but Death Becomes Her. And I was like, oh, we need to do that one October month sometime.
Oh, that is a good one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've never seen it, but, you know, it'll be a ride. I'll tell you that.
It's about the undead.
You know, the death. It becomes her. But death does not become Elizabeth. Mm. We'll find out about that sooner or later. Now it's an all-out war. Elizabeth is there to stay, thank you very much, and she wants her place back. So she torments David, or rather nags him. When he gets beer from the fridge, she's sitting inside the shelves and says judgmentally, "Oh, another one. How many has that been today?" David now takes showers in his boxers because guaranteed Elizabeth will be sitting on top of the toilet watching while he wraps a towel around himself. While he's watching a basketball game, she sings, "Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you tomorrow," at the top of her lungs until she drowns out the TV. Finally, David has had enough. He calls in a Catholic priest. Oh, the Catholic priest. Oh, baby. Oh, honey. Bless your heart. Who attempts to exorcise the apartment. He's flinging his holy water from side to side, completely missing Elizabeth, because he can't see her. She's standing irritated with arms crossed, unaffected by the ritual. She looks at David in disgust and says, "You're mopping that up." Next, David attempts a Chinese cleansing ritual where several ladies take flaming paper and flick it into the air before it burns out. David watches this from the couch with Elizabeth beside him, again unaffected. She tells him matter-of-factly, "They're just going to set off the smoke detector." Just then, the fire alarm blares on around them. Next, he solicits the help of some local ghost hunters. Let's use very heavy air quotes around ghost hunters, shall we?
Yes, but the soundtrack makes it all make sense.
Uh-huh.
They're ghost hunters, and they're playing the Ghostbusters song when they come into the apartment.
Yeah, and they're dressed up like they're in Ghostbusters, except to, quote, capture the ghost. They put down like a butter tray, and then they put a pyramid on top of it. Totally gonna capture right. That's gonna do a great job of capturing the ghost.
It is. Pyramids are imperative to ghost catching.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I've heard that.
Absolutely. Well, you were the one that went on the ghost tour, so you should know. Maybe they should have thrown down some cat toys. The ghost hunters claim to have captured the spirit underneath the butter dish. They present it to David, and we see Elizabeth right beside him shaking her head at the head ghost hunter, who I think is the dad of the other two ghost hunters.
Mm-hmm. Family business.
Yes, family business. Who loudly proclaims, "We've got the spirit. We definitely have him." And David is on strike three for the house cleansing. I'm surprised he didn't do like the primary one that everybody knows of, the smudging of the sage. I mean.
Oh, I know, right?
Yes.
Or a Ouija board, for goodness sakes. Come on. This is like basic ghost communication 101, David.
Yes.
In a last-ditch effort, he asks Daryl, the bookstore clerk, for help. Daryl sits there quietly inside the apartment. David, now full of doubt, asks, "Is that all you do, just sit there?" Daryl responds snarkily, "Do you want the bells and whistles or do you want a reading?" Unbeknownst to the book clerk, Elizabeth is sitting right across from him and critiques, "This guy is not for real. He doesn't even know I'm here." Daryl, in response, says, "I sense a presence." Elizabeth waves her hand in the air saying, "Oh, how original." To which Daryl says, "It's hostile and it wants you out."
This turns Elizabeth to his favor, especially when he adds, "You should move out, dude." She responds, "This guy's got a gift." And David responds, "I am not moving out." To which Daryl counters, "Can't you feel that searing laser beam of hatred focused right on you? She's not going to leave, bro. And besides, this apartment ain't that great." Both David and Elizabeth say simultaneously, "Yes, it is.
Seriously, can we pause a moment? This apartment isn't all that great."
Oh, I'm like, where do you live, buddy? Because I want to move. If somebody gave me this apartment for the low thousands in San Francisco, I would be like a tamer-shaped hole in the wall. Like, I'd be like, fuck yeah. It is huge. It's massive. It's like got so many original fixtures and charming little like details like crown molding and old original doors. And it's got that fucking terrace. That's a whole basically roof of an apartment complex. And it's got bay windows with seating underneath. I can go on and on. Don't even get me started. I had to cut two sections because it was just descriptions of this apartment alone.
And it was, and the views of Coit Tower, the bridges.
Oh,
and
it viewed everything. I'm like, this view is fake because it shows everything in the city.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I can't actually place that view, how those things can go together. But it's a magical apartment. And who am I to judge? And the wood floors that go throughout and the giant hallway and the multiple rooms. And I'm like, yes, please. Yes, please.
Yes. Yes. Anywho. The reading has apparently depleted Daryl because he smacks his lips together and says, "You got something in the diet cola variety? I'm about 99% parched right now."
David ushers his guest, who could really use a cola, to the kitchen where he chugs a can of pop. Elizabeth paces and argues, "I'm not dead." This causes her and David to get into a heated exchange, which to Daryl looks as if David is yelling at himself. Daryl offers, "This is the most alive spirit I've ever dealt with." David asks, "What do you mean?" Daryl responds, "I agree with her, dude. She's not dead." Both are dumbfounded because not only did Daryl sense what they were arguing about, he also knows she's a woman. He focuses attention on David and adds, "But you're carrying all this darkness. Your aura is sucking all the energy out of the room. You gotta let her go, bro." David responds, "I'm trying, but she won't leave." Daryl shakes his head. "Not your spirit, girl. The other one. The one you keep here." He points at David's chest, and Elizabeth sees an opportunity to deliver a low blow. "Oh, you were dumped? Probably left for a guy who didn't have a couch fused to his ass." This pisses David off, and he storms upstairs to the terrace, calling over his shoulder, "You don't know what you're talking about." Elizabeth stands there, dumbfounded, before Daryl tells him, "Sorry for your loss, bro." Then he focuses attention towards where Elizabeth stands and says, "And for you, you need to have some respect for the dead." Elizabeth goes to the rooftop to apologize. He initially ignores her, so she nervously rambles about how she got the apartment because of the roof, and one day she hopes to put a garden up here, she thinks. Finally, David tells her that the woman Daryl was referring to was named Laura, and she was his wife, and she did pass away. All of this emotional turmoil is too much for David, and he leaves the apartment in a huff!
In a huff!
He walks a few blocks, deciding to take his friend Jack up on his offer for a night at the bar because, you know, you have to drink just with other people.
Other people. Then yes. It's okay.
Yes.
Then you don't have a problem.
Exactly. Elizabeth follows him the whole way, imploring him, "Don't drown your feelings in alcohol." But he ignores her. Once inside, Jack is thrilled to see him, and he has brought along a couple of babes for them to hang out with. Woohoo! But David cannot shake Elizabeth and looks like he's bananas as he argues with her/no one. She ultimately takes over his body to stop him from downing a glass of scotch. And he fights her, convulsing and lurching around, much to Jack's dismay, as this is not a way to impress the ladies. And while they are joined, I have joined their names into D'Elizabeth. So
nice.
Yeah, thank you. Very original, I know. D'Elizabeth flings the drink inadvertently hitting a few female patrons nearby, the ones that Jack invited. They're not happy about it, shockingly. And Elizabeth forces David to leave. Once outside, Elizabeth pries herself out of David's body. He is pissed about the embarrassing scene she created and goes to a park bench to cool the fuck off. Once again, she follows him. He tries to push her off. Go bother someone else, which causes her to realize that she can't. She says sadly, "What if I am dead? Whenever I'm not with you, it feels like I don't exist. And why are you the only one that can see me?" He starts feeling bad and assures her, "You're not dead." This spurs her conviction into action, and she enthusiastically proclaims, "You're right. We have to figure out who I am." She looks at him hopefully, and before he can disagree, she adds, "You have two options. The first one is that a woman came into your life under very strange circumstances, and the second one is that you're insane and you're sitting here talking to no one." David likes the first scenario better and decides that if they can figure out what happened to Elizabeth, then maybe that'll get him one step closer to living alone in that sweet, sweet apartment.
Mm-hmm. Cut to David and Elizabeth becoming a PI team of sorts, but one of them is human and the other one is of a vaporous form that no one else can see, except David. They go door to door in their shared apartment building to try to gather some clues. The first three apartments are duds. Most are older tenants and all thought Elizabeth's unit was vacant because they never saw anybody coming or going. Things seem bleak until they knock on the last door. It's answered by a very attractive girl. She's pretty and wearing a workout ensemble that shows off her fit physique. She seems very interested in David and introduces herself as Katrina. Elizabeth is thrilled, thinking, "This person looks like somebody I would be friends with," but we won't find out what Katrina says about Elizabeth until after the break. We're back. And unfortunately, Elizabeth is sorely mistaken. Katrina calls her, Elizabeth, the girl upstairs, like a cat lady, but with no cats, and totally antisocial. Elizabeth is miffed and wants to leave, but Katrina plays damsel in distress and asks seductively, "Can you come unstick a window for me?" She's laying it on pretty thick, but David declines her advances, stating, "Sorry, I have dinner plans." Katrina flirtatiously says, "Well, I have dessert then." And Elizabeth irritatedly says, "Oh, God, I just puked in my mouth a little." David does his best to try to ignore his ghostly, but silent to everyone else, partner, and winds up awkwardly declining, shaking Katrina's hand and retreating up the stairs, with Elizabeth following as she rants judgmentally about the girl's attire and behavior. Mm-hmm. Finally, David turns to her and proclaims, "I've got to do these interviews alone from now on." She's taken aback and reminds him, "Hey, being here with you might jog my memory." But he protests, saying, "Being with you is like having an AM radio shoved into my head that I can't turn off." Elizabeth resorts back to Katrina and remarks, "Did you think she was unclassy and forward?" David responds, "Puh, that's two of men's favorite things." Ugh. He realizes that he forgot his keys, and Elizabeth helpfully tells him there's a spare one underneath the fire extinguisher. He finds it and unlocks the door, and inside, David throws open drawer after drawer until he finds some items that he doesn't recognize. They're clues. One is a dry cleaning ticket. There is an address and a book of matches. Elizabeth is thrilled and excitedly says, "You know what that means, right?" And he responds flatly, "That we can start a very small fire." And she states ecstatically, "No, there's still hope for finding out who I am."
So first they visit the dry cleaner, who reinforces everyone else's opinion that Elizabeth was nondescript and dull. And the pants were left for far too long, so they were donated to charity. Elizabeth is livid and surprisingly materialistic for being a ghost. She says haughtily, "You gave my pants to charity, but they were Armani." David drags her spirit self away, and they beeline to their next clue, which is the address they found. They pull up to a fairly nice home, but Elizabeth doesn't recognize it. David goes to the door, and an unremarkable middle-aged man answers. David says, Okay, I know this sounds weird, but do you know a petite blonde woman about 5'2"? David and Elizabeth are surprised when the stranger fesses up to infidelity, mistaking Dave for a private investigator and the description of Elizabeth to be his mistress. From the recesses of the house, the man's wife calls, "Who is at the door?" To which the husband hisses, "My wife can't know. Be back here at 6 p.m. and I'll have a check for you to make sure your silence is worthwhile." He then slams the door in their face. Back in the car, Elizabeth contemplates the possibility that she was a slut, one that would put Katrina to shame. They begin to drive away. She did not have enough time to be a slut.
She doesn't know that yet, though, Corinne.
True.
She could have been a very streamlined slut.
Efficient.
Like she could have.
Yes.
Yeah, efficient. She's an efficient slut.
Yes. She's like, "You in the waiting room, you are sufficiently attractive and look like you might have some money and you look like you're pretty healthy. Come this way." Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. "Have you ever done it on a hospital bed? I'll pull it full in L mode and we'll go at it."
Oh, L mode. Hello.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who needs a love pillow when you have a hospital bed in L mode?
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. Or even any other mode. I mean, shoot.
Yeah. I didn't even think about hospital beds as being good for creative sex, but what do I even know? You're just opening a whole new world. Tamara's sex den.
It's just by hanging out with all the streamlined sluts, you know. You keep some guessing, keeps them coming, keeps them going, keeps them quick.
Thank goodness. David and Elizabeth begin to drive away when directly across the street from the stranger's house, which I completely missed, Dr. Fran emerges. Thanks, Tamara, for doing such a great job with the script. And it's obvious to us, oh well, to Tamara anyways, that David and Elizabeth read the address wrong. They were one number off. Dun, 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 dun.
Dun. The last clue. Where does the last clue lead them? Why, to Moose's restaurant. Elizabeth recognizes it immediately and mutters, "Oh my God, Moose's, I love this restaurant." They rush in. David's glad to know that they're on the right track and hopefully someone in there will know her personally. But she dashes his hopes when she says, "No, I mean, I love the restaurant, but I never actually ate here. I always wanted to, though."
Aw.
David asks, "Why not? Were you a street urchin or something?" She knows that's not right, but she can't put her finger on why she never did, except to say, I don't know. I was busy." They're approached by the host, but decline a table, opting to leave. Before they get out the door, a man collapses unconscious to the floor. The staff and patrons surround him in a panic, and someone yells, "We need a doctor!" A glimmer of recognition hits Elizabeth, and she directs David, "Go over there and feel the man's chest." He rushes over, and after a quick diagnosis on Elizabeth's part, she realizes the man has a tension pneumothorax and tells David to ask for a bottle of vodka and a paring knife. With her guidance, David splashes vodka onto the customer and reluctantly makes an incision between his lungs and then puts the vodka pour in the hole. Air immediately escapes from the puncture wound. The man begins breathing again to everyone's relief, and this causes Elizabeth to realize, I'm a doctor. David and Elizabeth ask where the nearest hospital is, and they're directed to St. Matthew's, and that sounds really familiar to her. As she and David make their way down the street, Elizabeth says happily, "I may have been a loner and a slut, but I saved lives."
Once at St. Matthew's, Spirit Elizabeth begins recognizing things and people. David asks a nearby receptionist to speak to Elizabeth, and the receptionist's face falls. She asks, "Elizabeth Masterson?" Spirit Elizabeth next to him cries, "Yes, that's me!" But she's got the look of something bad happened. When David confirms it's Elizabeth Masterson, he is sent to the third floor where he's met by Dr. Fran. Spirit Elizabeth recognizes her mentor and knows if they're talking to her, it's not good news. Fran is trying to deduce who David is, and Spirit Elizabeth urges him to lie and say he's her boyfriend or else he won't get any info. Fran finds the relationship hard to believe because, well, one, let's start with how David's like, "Well, we're together." And she's like, how? Because he can't say she's my girlfriend because he still is like, "I love my wife who died tragically 2 years ago." So, but then
when we don't know that. Yeah, Corinne. Shh. Spoiler.
or who left me 2 years ago? One of those options. And so then when Elizabeth is like, girlfriend, Earl friend gay, he's like, I mean, she's my girlfriend. Yeah, so he wasn't super convincing, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Friend finds the relationship hard to believe because Elizabeth was completely consumed with her work, but finally divulges that Elizabeth was in an accident 3 months ago and fell into a coma. While they are chatting, Spirit Elizabeth hears a distant heartbeat. Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. And her body is drawn to a hospital room where she sees herself on a hospital bed. Not just any bed in the hospital, but a hospital bed. Yes. Hooked up to life support. David rushes in after her and exclaims. He doesn't exclaim.
This is boring. This is so dull. I saw you flying and I could not care less.
I have been up since 5:30 this morning. He exclaims, what was that? You were flying. He sees the figure in the bed and is surprised and relieved that Elizabeth's body is not dead after all. Spirit Elizabeth is still concerned because 3 months of a persistent coma means she's likely not going to wake up. She gazes down at her physical self and wonders aloud, it's like I'm not connected to my body. She tries lying her spirit body on her physical body to meld the two together, but it doesn't stick. She gets up dejected and discouraged. David asks her to turn around. Turn around. He wants to try something. She does, and he gently holds her physical hand, and Spirit Elizabeth immediately looks at her palm. She felt that, and he says reassuringly, see, you're still connected to this body. You're getting better. And this brings me to mention when he first sees her, he's like, you're so pretty. Like her body with the breathing tube in it. He's like, you're so pretty. You look so good. I was like, okay, David, let's just slow our roll a little bit here.
Oh, that's got a little too Cosby in it, that statement there.
Oh, yeah. No. I wasn't like that at all. But she glances at the beeping heart monitor and sighs. That's not what the machines say. He protests. Yeah, but machines don't know everything. She quietly argues. All my training tells me that they do. He looks at her in disbelief and asks, then how are we having this conversation? They're interrupted by Dr. Fran, who's got to go and can't leave David alone with Elizabeth. He asks for a few more minutes to say goodbye, and she agrees. When they're alone again, he asks Elizabeth if she wants to come home with him. He'll be way more cordial, and it's her place after all. She declines, saying it would feel weird to leave her body now that she knows where it's at. He understands and bids her a sad goodbye.
But Elizabeth is only at the hospital for a short while before she's visited by her sister Abby and her kids. You guys have gotten so big, get back here! As they run down the hospital corridor. But she's discouraged by the fact that they can't sense her presence or see her like David. And even more discouraged when she can't feel her niece's hands when they hold hers.
Aww.
The visit, however, is cut short by rival Dr. Brett Thurston, who asks to speak with Abby privately. When they're alone, he explains that the hospital all loved and missed Elizabeth terribly. Spirit Elizabeth stays close to her sister to hear the crock of shit bread is spreading on and sourly says, oh, you know you're doing somersaults to not be in Phoenix right now. Brett also informs Abby that Elizabeth signed a waiver to decline life support, and although they've been accommodating and keeping her alive, they're doing it against Elizabeth's wishes. Her sister realizes what the doctor is saying. He wants her to pull the plug. And even though Elizabeth's spirit self is protesting loudly and emphatically, no one can hear her. Abby tearfully gathers her girls and slowly makes her way towards the exit, with Brett matching her stride the whole way. He's laying it on even thicker about doing the right thing and asking for God's forgiveness.
Ew.
Before Abby finally snaps. She snatches the paperwork out of Brett's hands and says shrilly, I said I'd think about it! And leaves in a huff.
In a huff! And I'm like, okay. One, illegal not to be following her wishes. And two, who's this asshole? Well, that's why I call him Dr. Duty, okay? Duty head. That's really... because he's like, just ask for God's forgiveness. And I'm like, oh, fuck you and fuck you and fuck you.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Do not be talking
to me.
Well,
he's an asshole. And he's definitely trying to get rid of his rival in case she wakes up. Then he might have to, like, lose his residency and move on over to Phoenix.
Oh, yeah. No, my fantasy is that he has a temporary residency until everything ultimately pans out with Elizabeth.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Across town, there's a knock on David's apartment door. It's Katrina. She's locked herself out of her apartment. Oh, no. And wants to use his phone to call a locksmith. This is before cell phones were prevalent everywhere. While they sit and wait, she makes herself real, real comfortable. She grabs a beer, kicks off her shoes, and lounges on his couch while rambling on endlessly and, might I add, nonsensically. I'm like, what is she even talking about here? She only stops once when David asks, so the locksmith knows to call my unit, right? She shrugs noncommittally and asks to use the restroom. He points her to it and stands in the hall trying to figure out his next move. How the fuck to get Katrina out of the house? Thank you very much. As she strolls down the hall in her low-rise jeans with her G-string showing.
A bedazzled jean string. Oh, a bedazzled jean string, nonetheless.
I was like, that thing looks uncomfortable. Crunchy, hard. Yes. But.
Crunchy thongs.
Oof. I have to confess that I miss low-rise jeans so bad. Come back, low-rise jeans. Come back.
You're kidding, right?
I'm not kidding at all.
Wow. I did not like low-rise jeans. I did not like my butt cracks coming out and saying hello every time I bent over.
Low-rise jeans aren't low-rise jeans on me. By the time I get a jeans that are big enough to cover my badonkadonk, then usually what happens is I have a waist that is like up right below my boobs and like cutting into my rib cage and everything like that. But with low-rise jeans, once I get my badonkadonk covered, then I just have jeans that like rest at a nice place on my body in the front.
Okay. Low-rise jeans. Good for Corinne and Katrina and nobody else.
I hate to disappoint you, though. I do not have underwear to wear like that with the low-rise jeans.
Well, we're just going to have to remedy that when you find your next pair.
Okay. That's going to be really uncomfortable. Thank you.
I can just imagine all the accessories I could try to stick on the little 2 inches that's going to be hanging out your pants.
Oh, my God. Line. It's going to be like the friendship bracelets that everybody's going to be making for like Taylor Swift concerts and Obsessed Fest and all that. And so it's going to be like, Tamara is your best friend. Or something like that, like up my ass crack.
Or it's going to be like fucking Office Space with all the pieces of flair you could possibly fit on a teeny tiny string.
It's going to be amazing.
Crunchy thongs, people, the next big thing.
So much fun. So much fun. Well, back to the story. Elizabeth suddenly appears. David is so thrilled to see her. He completely forgets about fucking Katrina. And not fucking Katrina, but about Katrina, who is a fucker. And he greets her warmly until he finds out why she's there. Because Dr. Duty Thurston is pressuring Abby to pull Elizabeth's body off of life support. David argues, they can't do that if you're still alive. I know, she agrees. I tried telling them that, but no one can hear me but you. From the other room, Katrina calls David's name. David! And Elizabeth is surprised and jealous? She accuses, well,
question mark, question mark, question mark.
They have a special bond, Tamara. A love that cannot be denied, Tamara. Okay, Tamara?
When did this happen? Because I remember them being pissed off and annoyed and irritated at each other up until the point where they found her body and then it was kind of cordial. And then all of a sudden they have these hard, fast feelings for each other? Question mark, question mark?
It was the journey that brought them together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Elizabeth accuses. Well, that didn't take much time. He protests. She's just using the bathroom. But they both see that that's untrue as Katrina throws her clothes seductively out of his bedroom door. He's dumbfounded and Elizabeth scoffs.
You're trying to picture what she'd look like naked, David protests.
No, I'm not. Well, not enough to go over there.
Katrina emerges wrapped in a towel and says sultrily to David,
sometimes I hear you upstairs and I just wonder if you're lonely, because I'm lonely too. And what's wrong with wanting to lay next to someone?
Elizabeth, defeated and knowing she's no match for a human girl, sadly encourages David to be with Katrina. He continues protesting to Elizabeth in front of Katrina, and shockingly, Katrina doesn't see a man having an argument with an invisible person and think, danger, danger, back away, back away, back away, back away. No, no.
Mm-hmm.
She looks at him matter-of-factly and asks, do you want to take medication first or something? Elizabeth hurries out and David calls after her, Elizabeth, Elizabeth, Elizabeth. But he can't leave. He still has to deal with his guest, who playfully drops her towel and tells him, whoopsie, and the name's Katrina. Winky, winky.
Mm-hmm. I guess Elizabeth's giving him some alone space and takes refuge onto the rooftop terrace. Can't hear anything from up there, right? Before long, she's joined by David, and she tells him bitterly, well, that was quick. But he assures her nothing happened, saying, I asked her to leave and told her I'm seeing someone. Elizabeth smiles a little unsure until he adds, I didn't tell her I was the only one seeing her, though. She is elated because he likes her, vaporous form and all, and she feels the same about him. Amidst this cockamamie situation, they've developed feelings for each other. David gets quiet before admitting, I haven't been with anyone since Laura. Elizabeth finally asks what happened, and he quietly regales her with the details. She was just home, cursing at her shoe. The heel broke, and she just sat down, put her head in her hands, and then she was gone.
Aww.
Elizabeth nods slightly and asks, his cerebral hemorrhage? He confirms this and is still so mad that he couldn't say goodbye. A thought jolts him back into the current situation and he asks, but your sister wouldn't sign those papers, would she? Elizabeth doesn't know, but she knows that her brain activity is decreasing slowly every day, causing David to joke, maybe that's a good thing. You are kind of a smarty pants. This might bring you down to my level. She chuckles and tells him, you're not dumb, David, just a little lazy. Cute, but lazy. He assures her that he hadn't always been like this, and when she doesn't look entirely convinced, he asks if he can take her someplace. Show me how you do that place.
The one that makes me scream with hedges and greenery. And even though a moment ago they were standing on the rooftop terrace in the dead of night with the dark, inky black sky and stars twinkling above them, we next see them. They are crossing the Golden Gate Bridge in broad daylight. It is sunny and not foggy at all. So, San Francisco, am I right?
Of course.
Uh-huh. They drive north and arrive at a lavish estate.
Thanks. Elizabeth asks if they're trespassing, but David knows the owners are out of town. Besides, he tells her, we're not going inside. They make their way to the back of the house and into a lavish landscaped garden. David tells her that he was a landscape architect once upon a time and even had his own business for a while. And this is his work. Elizabeth wanders for a few moments in a daze and admits, this may sound crazy, but I've seen this place in a dream. And it's the exact garden she was sitting in her dream in the beginning of the movie. She marvels at the beauty surrounding her and says, it must be an absolute joy to create something so wonderful. David agrees and she encourages him to get back into it. They make a palm promise that he'll continue creating when his phone rings. It's his real estate agent who says, you're the luckiest boy in the city. The tenants, the family is going to give you a long-term lease. When he presses for details, he learns that they plan on taking Elizabeth off life support. He asks Elizabeth what dirt she has on her sister, because they gotta go talk to her. Stat! They head back, driving over the bridge with a terrible green screen background. And Elizabeth racks her brain trying to dredge up a secret so juicy that Abby would be forced to believe that David can communicate with Elizabeth's spirit.
Finally, she cries triumphantly, I got it! Abby kissed her old boyfriend JJ 5 minutes before her wedding. David agrees, that's a good secret.
So they take this verbal ammunition straight to Abby's house. David, once he gets inside, initially lies and tells Abby he knew Elizabeth because she was his doctor when he had meningitis. Yeah, that's it, meningitis. Elizabeth tells him, don't lie. And he gently tries to tell her sister the truth when Abby's daughters run screaming into the room. Elizabeth's disheartened. They were supposed to be in school, and now they can't say anything. It would be too upsetting to the girls. So David attempts to deliver their message in a roundabout way, saying, Elizabeth believed in me when no one else did. No one thought I'd pull through when I was sick, but I did. And I know Elizabeth will pull through, too, if you just give her a little more time. While this is going on, Elizabeth is sitting near her nieces while they're having a tea party. The youngest keeps looking up in her direction and even puts a cookie in front of her. But she doesn't answer when Elizabeth asks, Can you see me? Meanwhile, back in the kitchen, Abby is cheerfully telling David that it's too late. She already signed the paperwork and they're taking Elizabeth off life support tomorrow at noon.
Aww.
Abby gets choked up as she explains, My whole life I always told her what to do, who to date, and what to wear, and for once I can honor her wishes. This is what she wants. Out of desperation and amidst Elizabeth's frantic protests, David attempts to tell Abby the whole crazy truth about how Elizabeth's alive and standing right there with them. Abby stands there stoically as the weight of his words sink in. She calmly asks for a minute and then ushers her daughters out of the room. Elizabeth and David think the plan worked. She believes them. When Abby returns alone, she grabs a meat cleaver off the counter and chases David around. He delivers one more Hail Mary attempt and yells while dodging her slashes, I know about you kissing JJ at your wedding! This incenses Abby even more, and she succeeds in kicking him out. And once he's gone, Abby peeks in on her daughters to see if they heard any of that commotion. They didn't, but her younger asks, Is Aunt Elizabeth gonna have tea again? And this stops Abby right in her tracks. 'Cause what was that?
Outside Abby's house, Elizabeth is ready to accept defeat, but David has one more plan up his sleeve. They go to the bookstore to seek help from Daryl the medium. Daryl is not thrilled when he sees David because he senses his lady spirit friend is with him and says, You can't just bring spirits up in here. But David explains, You're right. Elizabeth isn't dead. She's in a coma. Daryl nods, Righteous. And David continues, But she's going to be taken off life support. Daryl nods again, Not so righteous. Then he looks at David and assesses Elizabeth's spirit. So, you guys socializing now? And David says, Totally casual. We've acclimated? Daryl nods sagely. Yeah, I can tell that. In fact, I'm sensing some pretty intense feelings she has for you, bro. Elizabeth protests. No, I don't. Can't we just focus here? Daryl chuckles. Ooh, major red aura. Someone's embarrassed. David reins in the convo. Okay, so is there any way we can get her spirit back into her body? And Daryl shakes his head. You're asking the wrong question, brah. The spirits that are hanging around have unfinished business. That's their deal. I have the gift, but I can't help them with that. David is helpful. Do I have the gift? Daryl scoffs. No. David asks, Then how come I can see her and talk to her when no one else can? Daryl nods sagely. Yes, that's the right question. Elizabeth and David conclude they must have unfinished business. They go back to their apartment and David frantically looks through his occult books saying, I feel like we're missing something. Amidst the stacks of books, Elizabeth sees the framed photo from her hospital room and asks, Where did you get that? David sheepishly admits, I took it from your hospital room. I wanted to have a picture of you and I didn't know if I'd ever see you again. She smiles sadly and says, That's nice. You know, it's my favorite picture. I just failed my MCATs, like, badly. And I wanted to study, but my sister said, Nope, we're burning your test results and going out for margaritas. And we had the best time. At my lowest moment, I actually was the happiest. But when I look at the rest of my life, I was just working, saving my life for later. What was I doing? Tears roll down her face and she says, I don't want to spend my last night crying. David tries cheering her up. Come on, let's go somewhere, anywhere in the world that takes MasterCard or Visa. Elizabeth admits,
There is something I'd like to do. And we next see them lying fully clothed on her bed, looking into each other's eyes. He asks, are you nervous? You shouldn't be, because I can't even touch you. She admits, I'm more scared because you can't touch me. When you took my hand in the hospital, I could feel it. My spirit could feel it. And if you could really touch me, I feel like it will bring me back. They gently press their palms together and David closes his eyes and says, I can almost feel that. Elizabeth looks at him seriously and responds, I think I know what my unfinished business is. You.
They fall asleep together, and the next morning David freaks out a little when Elizabeth is not by his side. Thankfully, she's just in a nearby chair watching him sleep, and he has had a revelation. He hurriedly gets stressed while telling her, this time I can do something, so I'm not going to sit idly by and let you die. He's practically out the door when he divulges his plan. I'm going to steal your body. Elizabeth's spirit chases after him, imploring, you can't do that. If you do, you'll go to jail. He stops before getting in his pickup and says, do you think it matters? Do you think I'll care if anything happens to you? At least it'll buy us more time. She protests because he's going to need a lot of help and equipment, and he reminds her that she can walk him through every step of the way. She's swayed, and she finally gives him a verbal checklist. Well, first, we're going to need a van and someone with no morals.
And also, we will need to watch 9 to 5 because they also took a body from the hospital. So I think we can get some tips from them.
But their body was dead. Elizabeth is alive. She's alive. She's alive.
True. Cut to David flying across San Francisco streets in the van with his friend Jack riding shotgun and Spirit Elizabeth in the back. She's appalled when she finds out that David didn't tell Jack the gist of their plan. Instead, telling him that they're having sales on hospital beds. You know how freaky you can get on those? It's going to be perfect. And he's always wanted one. Every boy's dream, a hospital bed. But the jig is up when they actually get inside and David beelines it to the supply closet. And Elizabeth tells him which medical equipment to pull. Jack finally stops the madness and asks, what's really going on? And David comes clean. He tells his bestie that Elizabeth's spirit is there with them and they have to seal her body or else she's going to be dead in 30 minutes. Jack tries to convince his friend to go upstairs to the psych ward, but David declines. I'm not crazy. Elizabeth is standing right behind you. Jack half turns, looking behind him and seeing nothing, duh. Jack says, okay, if she's really there, then what am I doing with my hand? Jack holds his hand behind his back and makes different gestures that David can't possibly see. Elizabeth lets David know each one of them, and they finally stop when she's like, is he flipping me off? We've moved from rock, paper, scissors, thank you very much. And David says to Jack, are you flipping her off? And Jack has a little bit of remorse in that moment. But he's still reluctant and asks, why is this girl so important to you anyways? David waits a beat before saying, because I love her. Spirit Elizabeth is stunned in the corner, causing David to look at her meaningfully and say, I mean it. I love you. Next, we see Jack and David donning white doctor coats, hurrying down the hall with an empty gurney, just like in 9 to 5. David thanks his friend, but Jack stops him by saying, I'm not doing this for you. Someday I'm going to need help moving a body, and I don't want to hear shit from you. And I wouldn't put it past Jack.
I know, but I was like, oh, sweet baby Jesus, now I'm scared.
Yeah.
I thought I knew you, and I thought you were my best friend, but now I am terrified of you.
We have questions. We have questions.
So many questions.
That we don't want to know the answers to, but we kind of do, but we don't, but probably we kind of do.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah.
At Elizabeth's hospital room, Jack recognizes her and cries, this is the girl I was trying to set you up with, the one you stood up, and she never made it because of her accident. David and Spirit Elizabeth stare at each other, finally realizing that this was the unfinished business. And then it dawns on her. She tells David, I knew you looked familiar. That's JJ. David says out loud, JJ, the one who kissed Abby? This freaks out Jack, who nervously asks, how did you know that? David points to the empty corner and says, I told you it's Elizabeth. And his friend is finally a believer. He didn't see her face, but now he's a believer.
She's nowhere in that place, but he's still a believer.
So they need to get Elizabeth out of their stat. But they only manage to get her into the mobile hospital bed before Dr. Thurston comes in. That bastard is 15 minutes early. David meets him at the door and lies that he's also a doctor who needs to do a few more tests. When Dr. Thurston picks up his phone to confirm this, David panics and socks him in the face. David and Jack quickly wheel Elizabeth out of the room, but not before they're spotted by Dr. Fran and Abby off in the hospital corridor. Dr. Thurston also gets his bearings back and calls security. The body snatchers bob and weave around people trying to stop them until they get to the elevator banks. Jack tackles the security guard into an open elevator car so David can escape. But when Jack raises his hands in defense, he realizes he accidentally ripped off Elizabeth's breathing tube. Shit, 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 shit. David, meanwhile, is still in the corridor getting surrounded by hospital staff. Spirit Elizabeth notices her tube's gone and she begins to slowly fade away. Her body flatlines and David pleads with her to stay, but she has no control. In a last-ditch effort, he attempts to give her mouth-to-mouth, but is quickly tackled by security. From the floor, he yells, "Somebody help her! Please!"
I thought he was kissing her.
I mean, yes and no.
Ooh.
Because he wasn't doing, like, the chest compressions. He was just like, he put his mouth on her mouth and then he got tackled. So maybe he was going to do chest compressions. Maybe he was just kissing her. But then that would just be, I don't know. I just said he's trying to give her mouth to mouth, mouth kissing, mouth breathing, kiss, the kiss of life. He's giving her the kiss of life.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Abby and Fran stand by unmoving because technically they're fulfilling her wishes. And suddenly Elizabeth's heart monitor begins to beep, beep, beep. Everyone looks at Elizabeth's body as she takes a breath and opens her eyes. Nobody moves except Abby, who looks at David in realization. Oh my God, he was right. Then she rushes to embrace her sister. Elizabeth recognizes her and Dr. Fran. But when David comes over, she doesn't know who he is. A teary Abby tries jogging her memory, but the insistence is just making Elizabeth panic. Finally, David tries to take her hand, but she moves it away before he can. And finally, he relents and leaves, heartbroken.
Oh, Dad. You give the princess the magic kiss, and then she rejects you. That's not the way the fairy tale is supposed to end.
Get the fuck out of my castle, David.
Seriously. There's no room for you here, David. I'm too busy having a fun life, David.
And by golly, you better put a coaster on that table, David.
If only you'd known how to use a coaster, David. Things might have been different between us, David. Then we get a sad montage of David going back to Elizabeth-less life all by himself. Still in her apartment. He's gonna be all by himself. While Elizabeth stays with her sister to heal. And even though she doesn't remember David, she always looks over her shoulder for someone. At the end of the month, David finally moves out and Elizabeth moves back into her place. Her sister drops her off and Elizabeth can't shake the feeling that something's missing. Maybe a hot brunette whose name is David, who looks a lot like Mark Ruffalo because he is Mark Ruffalo in real life. Just saying. Abby asks if she'll be all right, and Elizabeth assures her that she will. She's just a little out of sorts being gone so long. When she's alone, Elizabeth slowly wanders from room to room until she finally makes her way up to the rooftop terrace, and what was once barren is now transformed into a zen garden, complete with multiple archways and pathways. She stands in stunned silence until David makes his presence known. He apologizes for the intrusion, but states, "I just wanted you to have your garden." She asks, "How did you get in here?" And he confesses, "I used the spare key. You know, the one under the fire extinguisher." She looks confused, but doesn't move, so David assures her, "The last thing I want to do is scare you, so I'll leave." He only gets a few steps away before she stops him. He turns around, hopefully, only to hear her say, "The key. I need the key back." He obliges and holds it out to her. She searches his face and whispers, "How do I know you?" She finally takes the key from him and their fingers touch. A flash of recognition. That's when you drink and it just brings everything back.
See, when you said it, I thought it was flask, like flaccid penis. Like it's not quite a flash of recognition. It's a little inkling of recognition. Flask.
That too. Just a little boop. Yeah. Not quite. Yeah. A flash of recognition crosses her face and she says breathlessly, "It wasn't a dream." David agrees, "No, it wasn't," and pulls her in for a kiss. When their lips touch, all of her memories flood back to her. Her physical and spiritual memories unite, and she exclaims, "David, did you get the hospital bed on sale? I am ready for us to try some different positions."
Oh, Sleeping Beauty never took this turn, but still, here we are.
Or maybe she just says, "David." She knows him and kisses him passionately, and he knows that he has his Lizzie back, which is what he called her throughout the movie amidst her protests. But we didn't mention it anywhere before this point because it would have needed too much exposition.
Yes, but so Lizzie, he has his Lizzie back.
Yes. The end.
Oh, boy.
So, Tamara, how many dry kisses do you give Just Like Heaven?
Even though I accidentally owned this movie like 5 times, it's like that soothing balm of a movie that you can put in the background, but it doesn't resonate with me like it used to.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, like there's the problematic statements, you know, the lack of diversity in San Francisco and or anywhere. Period. And the fact that I couldn't tell when they fell in love, like it was kind of like, oh, you guys like each other now? Is that what's happening here? So that kind of like threw me back, because when I was doing, you know, the outline, I had to really analyze, and I'm like, yeah, I just don't see where it happened. Like it was almost in the unseen parts because they were playing PI and went on Elizabeth finding journey. And then when they finished that, they were like, I love you too. And I'm like, wait, nobody else is in on this because I didn't see anything that would justify those statements to each other. We're in love now. Okay. We're in love now.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of like the unwritten love story. Like literally they just hated each other one moment and loved each other the next, but still, like, it's a sweet movie. I love that you put that spin on it, that it's like a modern day Sleeping Beauty of sorts. Uh-huh. And I'm going to say, I feel like I've given this rating a few too many times for my own movies, but I'm going to give it a solid middle of the road 3, because yes, I think you should see it, but it's not like, oh, you have to see it.
Yeah.
It's a good solid romance. It's a good solid romantic comedy. I love John Heder in it.
Oh, so good.
I really wish he did more stuff, because even though he had kind of a little resonating Napoleon Dynamite in his performance, I'm like, oh, he could do so many things. Because
mm-hmm.
John Heder is almost a character actor. Like, who could I compare him to? Who's the guy with the beard that did The Hangover?
Oh, Jack or John or something like that. Zach Galifianakis.
Yes. So I put like John Heder kind of in the Zach Galifianakis universe,
mm-hmm.
whereas he's just got that specific something that if you need that specific something, like, works perfectly in those roles.
Yeah.
And so this role hit that spot, and I really wish he would have done more things after it, but I haven't seen any of it, so I'm assuming that he's not. I could be completely wrong. And as always, Mark Ruffalo is an absolute gem. Love his movies. He's always worthwhile seeing. Reese Witherspoon mm-hmm. was pretty good as a bossy little spirit girl too. So yeah, middle of the road, 3 dry kisses. Corinne, what do you give it?
I give this 3.5 dry kisses. Just, I enjoy watching it. You know, it takes me places. Not diverse. No, really not diverse. I do follow the love story a bit more. Like, you know, when they start playing PI together, they start bonding and getting closer and working towards a united front. And it brings them together in love.
Right, in the course of a day.
Luck. I'm just saying, when you get hit by the love bug, as you well know, Miss Tamara, who, you know, you bing, bing, boomed you and Larry together in 2.5 seconds. So they had been together mm-hmm. over weeks, appreciating each other in various
ways. Yeah, but we didn't start off hating each other. Therein lies the difference. We didn't hate each other in the beginning.
Sometimes hate is love.
It's indifference.
Oh, yeah. They always say it's like a thin line.
Yes.
Yep.
But yeah, so I enjoy it. It's a nice, easy watch. It's like a Hallmark movie. Except it's got Mark Ruffalo, Reese Witherspoon, yay, and John Heder, who I really loved in this role. He had such a nice little sweet vulnerability to him, which is sort of how I think he ends up in the Zach Galifianakis category. There's like a little bit of sweet vulnerability there, along with this extra other thing.
And a righteous performance.
Yes. I'm parched. I need a cola. So I'm giving this 3.5 dry kisses. So Tamara, what do we have coming up next week?
Next week, we're continuing on with our supernormal sweeties. I'm sorry, our supernatural paranormal sweeties. And we're doing the movie Beastly.
With Vanessa Hudgens. Woo! And also, the reason why I saw this in the movie theaters, Mary-Kate Olsen. Thank you very much. I love a good Olsen twin sighting.
I haven't seen Beastly, so I'm excited to watch this. Or am I excited to watch this, Corinne? You tell me. What's it like? Is it going to be a... You know what? We'll go over it next week.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it in 2011, and I have not seen it since. I thought it was fine then, and, you know, who knows what I'll think now.
A glowing endorsement, as always.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So... super interested to go down this trail. And if you have anything you'd like to say about Beastly, Just Like Heaven, or anything else, you can reach out to us. Oh, and also remember, it's my birthday month. Yay! You know what you want to do is give a present to Corinne by 5 stars, and you get a sticker in return. Woohoo! Anyways, you can reach out to us and via email. OneDryKiss@gmail.com or on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at OneDryKiss.
And remember, that's one spelled O-N-E. And as always, as Corinne said, if you don't leave a 5-star rating or review this month, you definitely don't love her.
Yes.
And we won't be sending you a sticker.
Aww.
Wah, wah, wah. But in the meantime, we really appreciate you stopping by, and we bid you adieu with one dry kiss. Mwah. See you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.
Then how are we going to have this conversation?
Then how are we having this conversation?
Oh, thank you. Then how are we having this? Did I mention that I got up at like 5:30 this morning?
I'm here to help.
Thank you. I appreciate that.